And welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Buer.
And I am GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns. And we welcome you guys back to We Are Going to Be For You, the lovely listener, a therapeutic Davenport of love as your downtrodden fan base gets another kick to the gonads as your Golden Gophers head into Wrigley Field, see it turn into Coors Field, and then see them be on the wrong end of a Matt Capps fastball as Northwestern comes back in the second half, a la 2013, and wins 38-35. Minnesota now falls to, in the PJ Fleck era, in games in which they have scored 35 or more points, 21-2. So there is plenty to get to. And luckily for us, we changed around the schedules to allow me to fly back from the Windy City. And that means that my second cousin, former Golden Gopher offensive lineman, and the star of this podcast, Derek Burns, gets to join us for this breakdown. Derek, you've had 24 hours to digest it. Do you need any Pepto-Bismol?
Oh boy. Well, I appreciate the flattering comments, Ryan. I'm glad to be back, win or lose. I do love talking college football, and I know our listeners also have the same passion, so it'll be interesting to get into it.
All right, so let's talk about this 38-35 loss for your Golden Gophers. On the day, I think we should probably start defensively because that is where we saw probably where we have probably the most gripes, and obviously some really encouraging things that you saw offensively. Still some things that are frustrating that we'll get into as well. But I think it's important to talk about the defense first. So let's just get right into it. On the day, I think it's just really safe to say that Northwestern was incredible. Preston Stone in particular ended up being 25 for 30, 305 yards passing. He had two touchdowns. Their running game was great. They ended up with 39 carries for 220 yards, a 5.6 yard average. I know that encapsulates some of the sack, or maybe it was one sack. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they were awesome. And, you know, Ryan, you let off saying that Griffin Wilde was going to be the main
Wilde.
I had to mute Matt Millen. I'm going to be really honest with you guys, so I didn't.
I heard that was an all time. I feel for Gopher fans the last 2 weeks. By the way, going from RG3 to what I heard was a horrendous Matt Millen performance. I feel for you.
Yeah, Wilde, you know, was as advertised. They targeted him a ton. He had 11 receptions for 111 yards. He was kind of just tactical, and he was awesome. And then is it Elgeron? He number 80. He was awesome. 7 receptions for 127 yards. Made some really tough catches. 18.1 yard average for him. All in all, just get into some more stats just real quick to close this up. But 525 yards of total offense for Northwestern. They were really pretty good at third down efficiency as well. They were 8 of 14. They were 2 for 2 on fourth down. They amassed 25 first downs on the day. If they didn't have so many turnovers, they maybe could have walked or turnovers. I should have said penalties. They probably could have walked away with this maybe even the first half too. But they were just really good offensively, and that was really the name of the game. So, Derek, what were the Gophers trying to do to stop this Northwestern offense, and how did Northwestern just find so much continual success?
Yeah, Gophers, you know, we're getting deep in the season here, so no big surprises. They tried a little bit of zone coverage early. It didn't go well, and so they mainly tried to play man coverage and mix in a mixture between pressures and dropping into coverage. What Northwestern did that was so effective, and we'll talk about the mistakes that Minnesota made on, you know, all three levels, but very, very simple what Northwestern did, but it was very effective, and that was this. They had scouted Minnesota. They knew that Minnesota's ability to stop people is based on the pass rush, getting to the quarterback. So if you saw that game, you immediately could tell that when Minnesota brought pressure, in other words, when they brought five or more on a pass rush, the ball was out right away. So the quarterback was many times throwing where the blitz came, which is, you know, that's classic. You want to, the blitz is off the left side, you throw behind it, you get to your check down. The ball was out early. Minnesota could not get to the quarterback with pressure when they brought it. When Minnesota dropped into coverage, so if they only brought three or four, the quarterback held the ball, waited for the routes to develop, waited for things downfield. And I think, Ryan, what we saw ultimately was that Minnesota's pass coverage, it was very, very poor against Northwestern. It hasn't been good all year, but it's been masked by the fact that Minnesota's been able to get to the quarterback in other games and get sacks and get pressures. Short of that, in this game, we saw what the coverage ultimately looks like.
It's just all, it's all supposed to go hand in hand. And when you are down your best corner in John Nestor and your leading tackler in Dev Williams, it compounds on itself. But I just feel like that's letting the defense and probably the defensive coordinator off the hook at this point, because it's not just the Northwestern game. That is the first thing I want to stress here is, if it was just the Northwestern game, I think we'd be having a different discussion. But let me get into more of why it's not. It's because it goes back further than this, where you look at even the Michigan State game, they gave up 467 total yards.
Yeah.
20 points on that, and they were very lucky because there were some incredibly untimely turnover and downs for Michigan State, missed field goals. Like, that was the start of this. And then it started to roll downhill and get bigger off the bye week in Eugene, where you have seven drives, I believe, as a starting defense. You give up six touchdowns, and you have the one takeaway, but you give up 510 total yards. Okay. All right. We're all thinking, okay, it's just a really good offense. Northwestern's not a good offense. Northwestern hadn't scored more than 22 points in a Big Ten game before. Not this season. And they put up 38 without much resistance in Wrigley Field. So I don't, and I pose this question to you guys, and it's one I'm sure many of people are asking themselves as they're listening to this. What does this defense do well? I when they don't get pressure, they can't cover, and they cannot take away the football, yet another game in which, Luke, we talked about it on the preview, Preston Stone had been, coming into the game, the most turnover-worthy play quarterback in the Big Ten. Guess what? Minnesota made him look like Johnny Unitas, or I guess I should use a random Northwestern quarterback. How's Mike Kafka for you? But he goes 25 of 30, 83% completion percentage, doesn't have a single pass hit the ground in the second half. Oh, wait, he does, but Minnesota's best player lines up offsides on a second and 21. We'll get to that whole sequence. But this is, it's the culmination of, now there were five road games this year, and PJ Fleck's defense and Danny Collins' defense allowed opposing quarterbacks to complete 77% of their throws for 280 yards per game with 11 passing touchdowns and no interceptions. And if we're just going to stay right here, Luke, with Northwestern and Preston Stone, if it just had been this game where Preston Stone, we talked about it on the preview again, he'd been completing 55% of his passes in Big Ten play. He hadn't been good. And you were, if you were to have only watched that game on Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, you would thought he's a Heisman contender. So, Derek, let me pose this question to you. Why in this specific game was Preston Stone, was it, I mean, you, I don't want to steal your thunder because I think you have some great points that you told us about in terms of potentially Northwestern changing their snap count, but why is it in this specific game, Preston Stone, just every throw that needed to be made, he made, and oh, by the way, his pass catchers look like NFL players again.
Well, a few things. First is, you mentioned not only did he not have any interceptions, he had 25 of 30. I would venture to guess the 25 completions, and I'm not exaggerating here, I think he threw to his first option 22 times. So what does that tell you? That tells you that Minnesota was being down a couple players, playing some young defenders in there. They were not able to disguise coverage. They were not able to make it difficult for the quarterback to to force him to go through his progressions. In other words, what he saw pre-snap is what he read post-snap, and the ball was out. That it just makes it a lot simpler for the quarterback. And again, without pressure, you're just able to sit back and it's pitch and catch. So I think that's number one, is having to play some guys, some backups that you can't have overly complicated calls on defense. You're limited to being simple. I think that played into it. You mentioned the snap count. We talked about this in the group chat, and that was something that jumped out at me on the rewatch, was being that when Minnesota brought pressure and we talked about the ball being out right away, the quarterback really used their clap snap count effectively to identify Minnesota's blitzes before they were coming. So they would line everybody up, go through the normal cadence. They'd do a quick clap, and the number of times, I mean, at least 6, 8, 10 times where Minnesota was going to bring pressure, they jumped, you know, not offsides, but they jumped and they gave themselves up. So the quarterback knew, okay, when the actual snap count comes, I know exactly where I'm going with the ball. So that made it. And then the third thing I would mention too is, and I know this is probably a separate thing we're going to get into, unfortunately, guys, probably more coverage busts and alignment busts in this game than any other this year. And I think that's a symptom of playing some new guys. That's, again, not understanding and getting the coverage calls in quick enough. And that was evident, and that killed them.
Yeah, I think, too, can I just add one thing to this, too, Ryan? Like, there were opportunities to force turnovers. You think about the Matt Kingsbury one that went right through his hands. The Gophers just didn't execute. You know, one that wasn't another one, I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, Coy Parrish ran down a guy, knocked a ball out. There were opportunities to turn them over, but they didn't do it. And, you know, it's funny where it comes down to, I know the game is 38-35, but those are the kind of plays that you need to make that can change the whole narrative of the game. And the defense just didn't, and they couldn't get the stops. I mean, Northwestern punted 3 times on the day. It was just a continual struggle. If you look at, for instance, game on paper, they do this great graph of expected points. It's almost a linear graph going up of expected points added. They just didn't face resistance, and that's the trouble there. Now Minnesota is basically on a very similar linear line. It's just the fact that Northwestern possessed the ball almost 40 minutes in this game, and that arguably is the difference right there. Their ability to run it and then continue to convert plays. Minnesota is almost too explosive in some ways. Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but there were plays to be made. They just didn't make them.
First of all, they only forced one punt on the day. They have forced one punt as a starting defense.
Oh, I looked at Minnesota's punting. My bad.
Whatever minutes they've been on the field.
My bad.
You're all good. I mean, here's the thing, and before we allow Derek to talk about the busted coverages and the busted alignments and why this defense is incapable of executing, I was down there in the Wrigley Field post-game press conference, and I'm was one of the ones asking the questions. And one of the things that just does not sit well with me, even 24 hours post, is Fleck talking about the young and inexperienced thing.
What's funny is I said that like game one or game three, but yeah, this is too late in the season to be saying that.
That's kind of my point with this whole thing is like, you even without Nestor and Dev Williams, like, you are where you are in year 9, because if you're playing young guys, you screwed up in high school recruiting. I've said this so much over the last month that even I'm nauseated at it, but I'm going to continue to try and bang this point home. I mean, without Nestor, you were playing a converted safety, and it's a great story in Jayonte McMillan, but he did not have a good day. You were playing a very banged up Zaquan Bryan, who I don't think has had the greatest of seasons. And then you were playing Mike Gerald as a freshman. Now he's a redshirt freshman, but why are you playing those guys? It's because your high school recruiting classes from 2021 to 2023 weren't much good, if we're going to be all types of grammatically incorrect here.
We should also add that they were really good at corner last year. Well, they had Justin Wally, right? But then they also had Ethan Robinson, who is a guy they got through the portal as well. Like, this isn't like a new thing. They've been patching that for a couple of years now.
Well, that's the beautiful part, and that's a natural transition to me also saying they brought in a transfer corner who they just don't play. So they whiffed on that transfer corner. You look at linebacker yesterday, without Dev Williams, Matt Kingsbury was almost playing like a de facto. Minnesota went with as much five down defensive lineman as I can remember this season. Derek, will you confirm or deny that?
Confirm.
Okay. And with that meant Minnesota was putting a true freshman out onto the field. That's who they elected to play in this game. Not Derek LeCaptain until the second half. Not someone like Jeff Roberson, who started at Oklahoma State last year and hasn't really played at all at this point during his Gopher tenure. Or someone like Mason Carrier. They made what they thought was the best decision, including not playing the transfer, who I guess isn't much good because they don't play him. That's another whiff. And then we get to the defensive line, who can't get a resemblance of a pass rush on Saturday afternoon. And guess what? They brought in three transfer defensive linemen. Two of them don't play. One hasn't played all season. And then for whatever reason in this game, I think Rushon Lawrence played about seven snaps. So we knew that there were going to be holes they needed to hit, and they whiffed in the portal. But also, they just have not been there with impactful plays. And again, the thing I feel the most confident about is in about 7 days, we're going to learn that Jalen Logan Redding has been playing through something torn in his knee. Since
yeah, for sure. State. Yeah.
Like, Nate Becker is a great story, but like, they're getting nothing from their rush, or they didn't get anything from their rush ends in that game. Anthony Smith, unfortunately for him, had probably what I would say was his worst game of the season. He was in position in open space, I think, three times to make a very impactful play.
Yes.
And he didn't miss it. And then I remember watching it live all three times, and then you see him visibly upset with himself on the field. I get it. But if no one can make a play, and you can't even, that's why the whole Fleck thing afterwards, talking about we're young and inexperienced, that's because you and your talent evaluators, and again, the thing that gets stressed to me by the people over on 15th Street?
15th Avenue, I think.
Avenue.
15th Avenue is recruit, retain, develop. Well, you obviously didn't recruit well enough in 2021 to 2023. And if you did, then you didn't retain them. And then I'd argue, where's the development? So I'm not letting that slide. That's why I've spent the last 5 minutes going over that. Trust me, it just does not ring for me, because they have to do better in the portal. They also have to develop these guys better. But Derek, if I saw one bust, I saw seven from this. I had this game specifically. I don't know that I've seen as many busted alignments, coverages, whatever you want to call them. Was it Northwestern now being the next Sean McVay, or why do you think we saw as many just screw ups from guys just running wide open to guys? I mean, the touchdown run in the second half there is going to be one that bothers me until the end of time, because they just weren't even lined up correctly. But what do you attribute it to?
I don't know if I can't say whether or not Northwestern was showing formations and personnel that they hadn't shown before. That's sometimes what the coaches will tell you is, hey, they came out with a package or a formation that we hadn't seen before. We weren't ready for it. That happens. If that's not the case, I have to chalk it up to, again, you have people playing on that starting 11 on defense that aren't used to playing with each other. So just to break it down, you know, for step by step here, you match up personnel. So offense comes out with what, 11, 10, 12, whatever personnel. You match that up with base, nickel, dime, whatever you want to have for defenders. Then you have to make your coverage calls based on the formation out of that personnel. And it's the safeties who typically make the coverage calls. It's their job to get the calls to the corners and the linebackers who are in coverage. And you saw, I'm not blaming the safeties, because we're not we don't get to hear what the back and forth on, well, did he get him the call and he didn't understand it, or did he not get him the call? So this isn't a blame game on one position group necessarily, but you can see pre-snap the number of times guys are looking back at each other, signaling, looking back again, yelling at each other. It wasn't happening. I mean, you look at one of the – and unfortunately, the drive that had the most busts was the one after Minnesota went up 28-13. And to Luke's point, you make a couple plays on that next drive, and you probably put the game to bed.
Yes.
And that drive, it was – I don't know the number, but several huge busts. I mean, you had one play where everybody's running man coverage, and Mike Gerald either didn't get the call. I'm not blaming Mike. Either he didn't get the call or he got the call and didn't understand it based on the formation, but he's in zone. So his receiver runs a shallow cross. He lets him go. Everybody else is downfield playing man coverage, and his receiver catches the ball and there's nobody within 20 yards of him. So that's one example of what we saw over and over. And then the touchdown run you mentioned, Ryan, Aiden Goosby clearly doesn't have outside contain because he's lined up at safety and he fills inside in the C gap and there's nobody outside. So the running back gets the handoff, you know, bends it outside as you'd see on any other running play, and there's nobody there. And so he basically runs on – it's a race to the pylon at that point. So either somebody wasn't lined up correctly or Aiden didn't make the right coverage call because there's no outside contain on that play. So that's what we saw on that drive, and that was a common occurrence. I mean, it wasn't – I don't want to over-exaggerate. It wasn't every play, but it was several times and key moments, and it was a big factor.
All right. So one thing that I noticed, Ryan, was that you did tweet before the game that Danny Collins was on the sidelines for this one, where he has traditionally been in the box. I honestly, it first blush was like, probably not a big deal. Like, this is going to be a weird stadium anyway. Who cares? But that is a notable difference. Not saying that that had a function in this game. All away games have been a struggle, but it's a good segue into just Danny Collins as a play caller, as defensive coordinator. We have largely, I think, we've avoided this topic to some extent, but I think it's non-avoidable at this juncture. This defense just hasn't been great. I don't even know where to go with it.
Showing, like, we talk about Fleck teams all the time. They're not showing improvement. They're getting worse.
So, like, the big difference for me is if you want to compare and contrast offense and defense, I've liked what we've seen from Harbaugh. Offensively, how he's willing to try different things, seemingly been able to push PJ to throw the ball more. You know, he's got a larger body of work in 3 years, etc. You have to be encouraged with what you see with Drake Lindsey. You know, there are still things that are a struggle running the ball, you know, etc. We can get into that later, but there are things to be optimistic about. I don't know where to your point, what does this defense do well? I don't know. But there aren't areas that I'm optimistic about. Now, we have just gone through, what is this? This is 2 or 3 game losing streak. Two for sure.
It's two. It's two.
Michigan
State and then went into the bye week.
But. Yeah. But even in that game against Michigan State, you don't have a ton of optimism on a team that, you know, had struggled offensively. It's frustrating. Because you'd like to see continual improvement. And usually with Fleck teams, you have seen that. But a cornerstone of that has been their ability to play solid defense. And that just hasn't been the case this year. And you really shouldn't lose games that you score 35 points in. Now, I recognize that I haven't watched a lot of Big 12 football through the years. And I also recognize that I was usually it was very late when I would watch Pac-12 football. So I should be used to this. But, yeah, it's just a frustrating situation. I don't want to throw Danny completely under the bus. Everybody should get an opportunity. But, like, if you're going to go and argue, Ryan, that, you know, he deserves a raise, like, miss me with that. We're going to get a cost of living situation here until you prove something better.
First of all, why am I catching a stray for saying it is what?
I'm just kidding. I like the ability to get a shot on you on the assistant coach talk.
I'll let it slide. A few things to that topic, just the Danny Collins discussion. You let off with Danny was down on the field. I noticed it right away, noted it on Twitter, asked PJ about it after the game, hit him with a, he's normally up in the box. Is that a baseball stadium decision, a coaching decision? So I feel like I might as well, being a media jackal guy, give you the direct quote from the horse's mouth. So this is what this is part of Fleck's answer to me about that. Why was he down on the field? So let's see. Quote, we felt like being down with the team, especially with some guys that are going to be playing today, we felt like him being down on the field would be probably a little bit better, especially on the back end. And then with us being in the baseball stadium with the view, probably gave us an advantage of him being down the field with his energy and his voice, end quote. So to me, that is not denying that part of the thing was they needed to change. And now whether that change was going to be coaching up some guys like Zach Harden and Mike Gerald and Emmanuel Carmo, whoever it may be that they were giving more opportunities to, trying to make more hands-on adjustments. Again, I see the process in it. The results obviously weren't there, but yeah. I see the process in it. Now, I think we all can acknowledge the elephant in the room. If you're moving a guy down onto the field, that's probably because things aren't going well. Now, the question is, why aren't things going well? And in this game, the thing that just gave me Rob Smith vibes was the amount of just MAs in alignment, MAs in coverage, MAs in guys just not making plays. Guys aren't playing fast. I mean, they're playing a step slow. And I don't know what the answer is going to be. I can tell you as we record here on Sunday night, I fully expect Danny Collins to be coaching against Wisconsin. And to me, the crux of this thing, and I don't want to make it sound too dramatic here because I don't know this to be true, but I think the thing that is going to be very interesting is Wisconsin's offense stinks. Okay. I say that not trying to alienate the Badger fan base because I think their defense is pretty good. I think they're actually really good defensively. But I read a tweet from one of the Wisconsin media writers saying that their win over Illinois, 3-score win over Brett Bielema's Illinois, that was the first time they had put up over 300 yards, and it was like 301 or 302 yards of total offense since week 2. Like, they are not a good offense. They're very banged up. They're playing like two different quarterbacks as QB3 and QB4. And if you allow that Wisconsin offense to put up 450 total yards or more, like the last three teams have, that is just not going to make a case for you to stick around. It's just not going to. And so I don't want to say he's going to be out here coaching for his defensive coordinator title, because I also, within the discussion, and I know everybody's upset at Danny, and I get it. Trust me, we've spent the last 30 minutes on it. I think the thing I want to pose to the two of you, because I don't want to put Derek in a difficult position here, is say you do move on from Danny. You want to be on your fourth defensive coordinator in 4 years, Tim Brewster?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not saying just because, again, I'm not saying that Danny has necessarily, again, earned the right to get a second season. Again, I don't think a lot of the defensive roster things are on him. You would say the most talented position on the defense is probably safety, mm-hmm. where Coy Parrish, I think, probably played his best game of the season all around, which is encouraging to see. Kerry Brown, I thought, played all right. And Goosby, like, it wasn't his position necessarily, again, what I thought, at least personally, making some of the poor plays. But that's the other side of the coin here, is I think a lot of people, and I get it, I will continue to say it, I get it, but I also just can't help but think back and say, like, I remember, like, when Brewster did that every year with offensive coordinators, and I'm sure the guy that Fleck would bring in would run a very similar system, because that's what Minnesota has recruited to, would be a 4-3 defense, and you can go find somebody, but is he going to want to bring in his own guys defensively? What do you do with the guys on staff? How do you make it all work? I'm just saying there's more things you have to think about logically that are going to be tied up in this decision. So I'll pose the question to you. I don't know where you both stand and where Danny where you think his job security is at. I kind of laid out where I think my thought process is at. Derek, I guess we'll kick it to you. I mean, how do you feel about potentially four defensive coordinators in 4 years? Do you think that's an asinine even topic to discuss? Mm-hmm. Where do you kind of stand here on the tree?
Well, I think that that evaluation has to be based on not just what the outcome is, but what the outcome is given the pieces that you have. I think the difference from this and a Rob Smith situation, which I still think is much worse, is Rob Smith was coaching a defense that had Antoine Winfield and a lot of other talented players.
Jamal Martin.
Yeah. A lot of, I would say more talent than the current group. And I would just, maybe this isn't a direct answer to your question, Ryan, but I'll get around to it. I look at this and say the main issue with the defense is cornerback, is being able to, first of all, they cannot play zone defense, which makes you one dimensional. So now you have to play man coverage. That changes the way your safeties can play. It limits what your safeties can do in the passing game. Now, the question that PJ has to ask in that evaluation is the reason they can't play zone defense and we have to play man and they're really not even that good at man if we don't get pressure, is the reason for that what you mentioned earlier, Ryan, which is we've had several busted recruiting classes, misses in the portal. Is it mainly a talent thing? Or is it, no, we have enough talent. We're not able to coach these guys up and teach them to play these coverages. If it's the latter, then you've got a coaching problem. And that's probably not going to be solved by another season. If it's the former, and so if you're putting a gun to my head, I do think it's more on the personnel. I do. This isn't me saying there's nothing wrong with the way they've coached or play calling. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying if I had to choose, I think it's a little bit more of a personnel issue that they're dealing with.
Yeah, and you know, my comment, Ryan, was not a knock on Danny per se. I understand he's young. I think you. Like here's a personal philosophy. I'll try anything twice, right? Usually that comes with food because I don't want to assume that the first time was absolutely brutal. And people can absolutely improve, and they should absolutely be given opportunity to improve. I agree with Derek in saying that you have to be able to evaluate this holistically. My frustration as it sits now, in large part is the fact that I don't see the improvement, and I get that there's one component is relative to the competition, but that's the part that I find really frustrating. We did see things I did like out of Collins is he recognizes, you know, the deficiencies that they have in the secondary and was willing to kind of throw the kitchen sink and try and get pressure. And some of those calls won them games. His inability to not do that against Cal probably lost them a game. And as a result, he made a change and did that. But in the same respect, this defense has struggled. That said, too, I've been saying from the very beginning, especially defensively, they're playing a lot of young guys, and I would have liked to see more improvement. We just haven't seen it. You know, Mike Gerald's been hurt, Saquon Bryan's been hurt. You know, especially corner where you're definitely
already
struggling.
Coming into the season, and you knew it.
Yeah,
I mean that's where I do want to note. We did ask again. I'm always told we don't ask the tough questions. We asked. You know, how does Fleck kind of view Danny's first year? And it's like you guys were reading off a transcript, because it's one of the things that I've talked about this for a long time on this podcast that Fleck always looks at, or at least he says he looks at. He evaluates it on three things. Is it coaching? Is it personnel? Or is it scheme? And that is going to be the question that I am going to be very curious what he comes to the conclusion of. I would say, in my discussions with Gopher coaches, and especially ones that have left the University of Minnesota in Fleck time over his 9 years here, here's what I will share, is that Fleck is more involved on offense, certainly, than he has defense or special teams. That makes sense. He was an offensive coach. He played on offense. He knows offense more than he knows defense and special teams. He's a football coach. He can understand things on all three phases of that. But I believe he thinks he knows how to fix things on offense more than he does on defense or special teams. So that's where it's going to be curious for me to try and glean here in the next week here before coaching carousel madness starts to kick off and different types of things. I mean, where does he try to fix the defense with when it's probably not the side of the ball he knows the best? And maybe some people think I'm making a bigger deal out of that than I should, but I also think that's kind of the reality of the way the world works. If that's how he's going to look at it, and he's not as involved on the defensive side because he was never a defensive coach, is he more liable to stick with him because he's going to trust what the people who do know defense are telling him? Or is he more prone to make a change? I don't know the answer to that right now. Like I said, as we record here Sunday night, I expect status quo going into Wisconsin, and we're going to see how this team performs at home. Now, I will also say it is remarkable. Now, Pro Football Focus isn't the end-all, be-all, boys. We all can agree on that. We've talked about that over the years. But it is remarkable to look at the defensive line splits at home this year in terms of what their game score grades are and pressure rate compared to what they are on the road. They are truly night and day. I mean, they can't play much worse as a defensive line unit on the road compared to what they have played at home. So the hope would be when you get to come home and play in a 30-degree game against your biggest rival that they show up the way that they have at home, where Minnesota is 6-0 as we record this. But I don't know the answer to the Danny Collins discussion. It's one that I'm glad we're having. I'm glad we're having it in a manner that isn't just, bah, fire Collins.
Yeah.
Bah. Yeah. It's not as simple as that.
No.
Again, it's very complex on all levels. So the thing that you have to put yourself in the shoes of, and we've spent a half hour on this already, is what do you put the defense's issues on? Is it the coaching? I mean, coaching, personnel, and scheme are all parts of it. They all deserve blame. But my favorite analogy, especially as we get into Thanksgiving week here, is think of it as a pie. There's going to be three slices of that pie: coaching, personnel, and scheme. Which do you cut the biggest slice of and put the biggest blame on versus what do you think the head coach does is going to be a fascinating thought exercise here. But the reality is on Saturday afternoon, I mean, there is one drive I want to talk about specifically. And Derek, I mean, you talked about the one where Minnesota goes up 28-13. Then Northwestern scores in under 6 minutes, goes 86. I think it's 86-yard drive that ends in a touchdown. But the one that really bothers me, and I know no one can see me, I'm shaking my fist angrily at the air here, is the Gophers score their 35th point, and then they give the ball back to Northwestern with 8 minutes and 20 seconds to go, and PJ Fleck has all three timeouts. And guess what? The offense does not get the ball back until 45 seconds are left on the clock and no timeouts are left. That, and I wish I could swear on this podcast because Lord knows, I think you both know, I can be like a sailor at times here. That bleeping bothers me. You had ample opportunities to get off the field at any point on that 14-play drive, and you just, your inability to get a single stop, force a single takeaway, do anything positive. Again, that reminds me of the Penn State game last year, where everybody wants to talk about the left tackle throwback. How about we remember that they gave the ball back to their defense with 6 minutes left on the clock and all three timeouts, and the offense never saw the ball again. This, to me, is incredibly similar. You give Northwestern the ball back with 8:20 because you scored the touchdown to tie it up. You're thinking to yourself, all right, we figured it out. Here we go. And then they don't even really get a shot at the very end. Now, Coy Parrish helped them with field position, certainly, but 8 minutes and 20 seconds left, and you allow Northwestern to have a 7-minute, 27-play drive. 14 plays, their second longest of the day. And may I remind you two handsome gentlemen of this. They converted on that drive, Northwestern, a 2nd and 13, And the one that is going to, and I tweeted this out at the time. I mean, I was tweeting myself through it in the press box. You had it second and 21. And guess what? You line up offsides on the next play after, by the way, that would have been the only incompletion of the entire half for Preston Stone. And then third and 10 out of the 2 minute timeout, you screw up out of the zone coverage on third and 10, allowed them to convert. Fleck burns all three timeouts. Then you never gave your offense a shot. Am I just dying on this hill that wasn't the most important drive? I mean, they're all important drives, but that one was just a shot to the heart watching live. And you just knew you were getting drained slowly there. You just knew it, boys.
Yeah, that was a backbreaker, and it was what Minnesota likes to do in that scenario, or what in previous to this year in a ball control running Minnesota team, what we like to do. But I think a couple things played into that, Ryan. One was you mentioned the splits in Minnesota defensive line play, home versus away. The split in this game, first half to second half, was also as drastic. The second half, the pass rush was done. They got absolutely no pressure in the second half whatsoever. Now, part of that, I do have to pause and say, Northwestern offensive line play and blitz pickup was outstanding. I know their offense isn't very good. I know you covered that, Ryan. I agree. I know, but that was part of it. But I think the defensive line was so worn out or tired or just didn't have anything left that you're not going to get pressure on the quarterback. So then
note here before I let you go on.
Yep.
I'm glad you said that. Anthony Smith played every single defensive snap in this game. He played 76 snaps. Tell me that doesn't reek of a defensive staff trying to do everything they can. But in no possible world can you play a 280-pound lineman 76 snaps, and to your point right there, expect him to have any juice left in the final 30 minutes.
There was nothing left in the tank. So then you say, well, okay, then how, if you're not going to get pressure, then how do you turn them over on down? How do you force them to punt, turn them over on downs? You have to either get a turnover or you have to break up a pass, which brings me to my final point that I texted in the group chat. I said something sarcastic about the Gophers not being able to get a pass breakup. And I asked Ryan, I said, where are they at this year? They are second to last in the Big Ten in pass breakups. Yep. That is just, it's another piece of evidence towards not being able to play tight coverage. When you play primarily man coverage, which is what they've had to do this year, you better be breaking up passes or getting a lot of sacks, because that's how you have to stop teams from passing. It's you're not going to get the opportunities for interceptions that you are in zone coverage. So the fact that they're getting second to last in pass breakups and they're playing mostly man, that's more evidence of the inefficiency of their coverage. And that's what we saw on that last drive.
Yeah. And then lastly, I'd say Northwestern first half to second half just cleaned things up. Like they didn't have nearly as many penalties. If memory serves, they had 8 first half penalties. They had 2 in the second half. Now we could question whether or not they should have had more penalties in the second half.
Oh, we'll get to that final drive. But, I can assure you.
Yeah. But let's take a quick break. Then let's maybe talk a little special teams. We'll get into the offense and wrap this thing up. It's been a fun one so far. I think it's only going to get more fun. So stick around after the break. Ryan, once again, we need to talk about our partners at Blue Horizon Energy. And we talked about previously that, honestly, energy prices are just growing rapidly. They're growing faster than the rate of inflation. If you look at their projections going into 2030, that the increase could be anywhere between 28 and 46%. It could be between 15, almost 16 cents to 18 cents. That's more than triple the cost in 2003. Ryan, the only way that you could get ahead of this if you're a grower or a business operator is to invest in renewable energies like solar array panels, like what Blue Horizon Energy installs.
Look, I know we have a lot of listeners on this podcast, and we love each and every one of you, but we know there's plenty of you in the ag community or in the commercial businesses. And energy, as Luke said, is only going up. So where can people go if they're trying to find a way to lower their cost, Luke?
If you want to learn more about ways to be able to save on those rising energy costs, go to bluehorizonenergy.com/gridiron, fill out the form, and they will get in touch with you. Again, that is bluehorizonenergy.com/gridiron. Ryan, I don't know if you noticed, but all of a sudden it's already November, and you know what that time is. It's open enrollment time. So while you're thinking about life insurance, or I shouldn't say life insurance, health insurance, looking at maybe making a change there, you know, this is a good time to also think about your auto, home, life, all maybe your ATV insurance, boat insurance, and the Burns Insurance Agency can help you shop during that open enrollment period.
I mean, absolutely. And that's where the independent insurance agent himself, that is the Burns Insurance Agency, located in lovely downtown Oakdale, Minnesota. For myself as a client, I've talked about this story before, but we had a hailstorm come through here in Roseville. And initially when the adjuster came out, he told me to go shove it, that there wasn't enough damage. Well, guess what? My insurance agent came out with our own roofing people, took the quality photos, said, nah, we're not going to shove it. And I got a brand new roof out of it for only my deductible. And it's because my insurance agent puts in the extra effort. You're not just a number on a spreadsheet. Or even, I love to tell the story last year of Austin coming up to me on Oak Street before the Gopher game and saying, hey, he and Tina, they saved you $700. Appreciate it. Well, he found me here just a few weeks ago. Guess what? They switched him to a different insurance here in 2025, saved him $1,000. On his home and auto. That is the beauty of an independent insurance agent. They're not loyal to anyone except their client, which is you. So if you want to give them a shout today, shoot them an email, bill@insurancebyburns.com, or check them out online, insurancebyburns, all one word, .com.
All right, we're back. The Gophers put up 35 points, fellas. That was awesome, but we should talk a little bit about the special teams here, I think, first. It was the good, the bad, and the ugly in this specific game. I am going to take that. Let's go with the really good. Ryan, how much were you sweating at one point thinking you might have to take your pants off in the press box there? Because I was feeling pretty good there for a second.
I'm not joking when I say I tweeted about it afterwards, and I think I had probably 10, 15 tweets, and I appreciate each and every one of you for thinking of my milky white hamstrings grazing the sunlight of Chicago. But I said it to Dan Owen, who was sitting next to me, right before the moment Coy Parrish took that kickoff, I said, look at the blocking. He's going to do it. And he burst across midfield, and I'm sure he's getting some guff. Do the kids still say guff? Is that still a culturally relevant? I know, first of all,
he's getting some shade.
Luke,
that's for sure.
Luke doesn't get to answer any of these anymore.
Ryan, I don't even think the parents say guff anymore. All right. I think that's just grandparents.
He got some shade. So,
all right. Well,
it was a great angle. It was a great angle, though, by the kicker.
Getting chased down by the kicker there.
Yeah.
But Coy Parrish, they, for whatever reason in this game, were able to give him their best blocking performance in front of them. And because of that, Coy Parrish returned 6 kickoffs on the day for 38-yard average, including one at the very end to put Minnesota at the 44-yard line. So
yeah,
we're very excited about that. I also feel like we need to give some congratulatory celebration pats on the back to the long snapper that is Alan Sukup.
Yes.
For running all the way down the field to be right in the face of the punt returner, jumps on it. I know the kids on the team call him Sippy Cup. And for the record here, we are a pro long snapper podcast. From Brady Weeks to now Alan Sukup, I cannot remember. Can you remember off the top of your head? Again, the long snapper is someone you shouldn't really know the name of. That's how you know they're doing their job well. Can you remember a bad snap here?
I'm not going to say because I don't want to jinx it, but I will say too, Ryan, that Coy Parrish was also good in the punt return. He had on the lone punt return, he had a 12-yard return. Not incredible, but I mean, still good. So returns were good. Coverage was okay. I don't think there's anything in particularly bad on coverage. Punting was there. We get to get a. It's fine, right? Extra points were good. Field goals and maybe kicking field goal decisions, not great.
So does this mean I get to, again,
let me take this. There is a 3rd and 5 missed. So you have 4th and 5. It's a 48-yard field goal. Derek, knowing what you know, are you going to go? Do you call that 3rd and 5 different? Do you play that different? And do you go for it on 4th down? Do you run the ball in that situation? I don't know. Anything different?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I've based, I'll base the answer to that question off what Ryan has told us all year, which is that we don't have a kicker that's very accurate over 40 yards. I mean, that's so, if you're using the percentages, if you're a metrics guy, you set that up to go for it. I mean, seriously. And it's easy for me to say that now, hindsight, yada, yada. But, it's pretty evident that the statistics are there. Ryan's confirmed it. But I will say, I am not the least bit shocked. PJ Fleck likes nothing more than long field goal attempts. So I wasn't surprised that it happened that way.
I will say, I mean, you talk about should they have set it up. That 3rd and 5 should have been completed if the right guard does his job.
Sure. That's fair.
I mean, even that 3-play sequence, again, I don't want to just single out one guy, but those were the final 3 plays for Marcellus Marshall at right guard, was that final kind of sequence there where Minnesota gets into 1st and 10. They run it for 5 yards. 2nd and 5, it's an MA by the right guard. And then 3rd and 5, Logan Loya, the guy everybody wants to see catch a football pass, he's open across the middle. Drake's pass is right there, but it gets deflected because there was an MA at the line. And then guess what? Tony Nelson, the pride of Tracy, Minnesota, gets the rest of the game. Like, we even asked after the game, was that a injury situation at right guard? Yeah. Was it play? And Fleck confirmed it was not injury related.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to, and that should have been a conversion, and they should have kept rolling there. But the discussion of 4th and 5 at the Northwestern 30, and then it's a 48-yard attempt. I know that very good friend of the podcast, Daniel House, wrote about this, that if you want to look at should Fleck have gone for it, what did the expected points kind of say? I know House wrote that it was essentially a 50-50. But if there is even a slight chance of 51-49 at this stage, we have learned that Brady Denneberg from 39 yards and in is a very good college kicker.
Yeah.
From 40 yards and out.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not even close is the problem.
What?
The two attempts, like neither of them were like, oh, and they just missed outside. Like they're pulled down the left field line foul.
Yeah. It's, I mean, the first one from 48 yards started right. Didn't even hit the net right, kept going right. And then the second one to tie the game from 40 yards starts left, doesn't come back left. And that's where I just cannot fathom for the life of me. And I've told people over at the Gopher Football Complex this, like, I can assure you they are well aware of my thoughts and feelings about this. And whether you want to say I'm validated in that or not, like, Brady Denneberg, unfortunately for him, and I don't blame the kid because I don't think he should be put in this situation. He was 3 of 9 from 40, and they took him because he had a relationship with Bob Ligashevsky, who's the special teams coordinator, and he's been great on kickoffs. He's been great from 39 yards and in. But guess what? No one loves a field goal more than Philip John Fleck. And so for them to continually trot him out there when he's 3 of 9 coming into this season, and now he's 2 of 7. So let's do the math there. What is that? 5 of 16 from 40 plus? How much more data do you need to see that you need to throw out Daniel Jackson from 40 plus? I have no idea if he's any better. I'm not a practice. And I have asked Fleck about the kicker situation. I asked him earlier this season, and that was the thing he pointed to me, was I evaluate it day by day in practice. I don't really care anymore. Like, there is at no point when there is a 40-yard field goal attempt or more against Wisconsin or whatever the bowl game is, throw at Daniel Jackson. I've seen enough there, okay? I just cannot fathom that Fleck and Ligashevsky and whoever else was involved, there are 2 portal windows that they went to and said, this is all we're going to add. And I just cannot fathom for the life of me. And yeah, I get to have the benefit of hindsight analysis here. But all of you know that I've been screaming this from the top of the roof for now 11 months, yet no one listened. And now here we are where it finally cost them a game. It's just, I feel for Brady Denneberg. I do. Again, I just don't think he should be put in this spot at this stage. Throw someone else out there from 40 plus. It's not this. It's not that difficult to do that. And then if a different guy misses, well, you can look me dead in the eye in the postgame press conference and say, we tried something different. I'd also tell you, how much longer of a leash does Lig get when Dragan Kesich missed more field goals than I think he was tied for the most amount of missed field goals in the Big Ten in 2024. And now we're having field goal kicking issues again here in 2025. You can say that's bad luck. That's college kicking. I bet you some of that is true. But these kicking issues, for the way Fleck wants to play football, you could argue there's no more important piece on special teams than the kicker for Fleck. And they just have not been good enough the last couple of years.
Yeah, so let's put a bow on special teams. Yeah, the two missed kicks don't help you. You know, the decisions around the two missed kicks don't help you. So let's go into the offense. So again, the offense scored 35 points on the day. Drake Lindsey was, I mean, if there's anything to be encouraged about this football team, is it feels like you have a signal caller that you can build around. Drake Lindsey, 20 of 30 for 264 yards, 4 touchdowns on the day, a couple of absolute dimes as well. Running the ball, you know, you look, it was 17 attempts for 59 yards, 3.5 yard average for the team. That factors in the sacks, etc. But Darius Taylor, 10 carries for 41 yards. He clearly doesn't seem healthy to me, like 100% healthy. We can get in that later. Femi Ijeboy, 5 for 23. They had 4.3 and 4.6 yards, respectively. You know, and we have to acknowledge that Darius Taylor had one long run of 27 yards. That was definitely contributed to the average looking pretty good. But
to be honest, if we're going to say that, that run should have been for 77 yards.
100%. Yeah, and that's the injury piece that I thought we'd get to if we get to that drive. Yeah. Javon Tracy had himself a day, 4 receptions, 3 for touchdowns, 87 yards in total, a huge, absolutely huge contested catch that ended up being a touchdown. Malachi Coleman had a huge 52-yard reception, making up for one that he maybe misplayed earlier. Lamecki Brockington was solid again, 43 yards on 4 receptions. Darius Taylor, you know, 6 receptions, no surprise there. Jalen Smith made a couple plays. The tight ends sprinkled in here and there. The tight ends also interfered with here and there. But, you know, that's for another part of the conversation. All in all, guys, the offense definitely, you know, made some plays. You loved after the turnover on special teams that they went and, you know, went for the jugular, went for the explosive, got it, scored a touchdown. Just awesome. There is a lot to be excited about. And then there's the frustration in the running game, too, that still exists. And I think both of those things can be true. But, Derek, what did the Gophers do in this game that, you know, helped them to find success against what had been a pretty good Northwestern defense?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, you know, this as refreshing as it was on offense, we have to keep in mind Northwestern has had a good defense, and they've actually gotten a lot better as the season's gone on. If you paid attention to their games as of recent, they've had a pretty stout defense, and quite the opposite of what we were saying about the Gopher defense. It's nice to see the offense progressing, getting better in some areas. So Northwestern ran predominantly man coverage. That's what we're seeing. We've talked about that in previous podcasts. That's how people are defending Minnesota. So what Minnesota did, which was, you know, just, you know, made my day, was finding single coverage downfield and taking those shots. You know, we've talked about that ad nauseum going back 2-3 years, is if they're going to play man coverage and they're going to try to you know, shut things down at the in your passing game. If they can't get to the quarterback, you have to go hunt a big play downfield. We saw them do that, and we also saw them saw Minnesota develop something in the running game, and that being outside zone, which was really refreshing. So those two things, and I think the third I would say is I really have to appreciate the creative play calling that they're to which Minnesota is going to the extent of, because they are limited in some areas. It hasn't all been great on offense. They've had issues on the offensive line first and foremost. They've had injury issues at running back. They've struggled to get off of man coverage. So when you're dealt that hand as a coach, as a staff, I'm not just talking about Greg Harbaugh, but all of them, I think they've done a pretty creative job of, you know, thinking about the first touchdown play where, you know, they run a weak side pitch and they walk in, and then the fake tush push where they run a, you know, kind of a sweep outside. They've really leaned into some things in the screen game. They've gotten creative with how they can get Darius Taylor the ball when he's healthy. So I think all of those things together, it was just, you know, obviously we're talking Jekyll and Hyde here because defense was played so poor, but the offense was good. And that was, it was nice to see some things on that end and see them progress in some areas with the hand that they've been dealt.
Yeah. Just for context within Derek's Northwestern defense statement, Oregon scored 34 on Northwestern. Michigan, a ranked team, scored 24, and USC scored 38. So for the Gophers to score 35, I mean, I would tell you that's pretty good. I led off with the stats on the podcast where the Gophers in the PJ Fleck 10-year prior to Saturday's loss, when scoring 35 or more points, were 21-1. 21-1, 13-1 in Big Ten play. The only loss, and we're all thinking about it, is that COVID year loss to Maryland where they lost 45-44, which unfortunately for Fleck.
Kicking problems in that game too.
A missed extra point didn't force another overtime in that game. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, okay, throw out the COVID one. How about that, Ryan? When was the last time the Gophers scored 35 points or more and lost a game before that? You'd have to go back to one of Luke Buehr's favorite years, 2010. I was a junior in high school when Tim Brewster lost to South Dakota 41-38.
I was at that game.
Why do you think I referenced that? That's one of your favorite games. I think you met your wife, your future wife, at that game.
No, absolutely didn't. I do remember being excited that there would be a new university president after that, and then we could get a good athletic director, and I had all the theories after that game.
Oh, we're going to get into that in this podcast, university president, athletic director, donor support, stuff like that. So for those of you who have made it this far, we're going to get to some more stuff there at the end. But 35 points in a Big Ten game should win you that game. 90s, I don't know what their percentages would be, 95% of the time, let's say. And unfortunately for Minnesota, they were on the wrong end of it. And I'm glad you guys brought up the points that you did, or at least Derek, with they tried, man. I mean, Drake Lindsey had his highest ADOT of the entire season. In no game that Drake Lindsey has played in this season was his ADOT higher. Now, Ryan, what's an ADOT? Average depth of target, how on average the far the ball was traveling past the line of scrimmage in the air. It was at 12.4 yards on 30 pass attempts. My man was slanging that thing, and Harbaugh was dialing it up, because I think Minnesota got the impression very early where the offense, yes, they don't come out to another fast start. Well, why? I'm so glad you asked. You get to a 3rd-and-1 on the opening drive, and then your receiver false starts, which, don't get me started about that. And then on 3rd-and-6, Derek, let me ask you a question. On a 3-man pressure, why are they getting home as a defense within 3 seconds again?
I can't answer why, but I can tell you that that is not going to be a – even if you get the ball out, that's not going to be a completed pass.
So it's execution, and that's what I'm saying, not what Derek Burns is saying. That's what I'm saying. But once they started to figure this thing out, again, you get the long kick return, and then you throw the pitch out to Darius. Again, you have the muff punt, first play after a turnover. Let's be aggressive. They go with a deep crosser to Javon Tracy for one of his touchdowns. I will also say, I cannot speak out of both sides of my mouth. Lord knows I have come down on this receiving core all season. I also have to give them their flowers because guess what? They made contested catchers in this game. They had five. That is the most they've had in a game all year. Javon Tracy was responsible for three of them. You saw Malachi Coleman learn from the first deep shot where that's going to be the thing for Malachi Coleman to really grow into what the recruiting star ranking was. And we all can see the athleticism and the strength and the speed and the size. It's my boy, you are, I walked next to him out of Wrigley. I know I am 6'4". I know I am. He has got an easy inch on me, but we got to go up and grab the rebounds. And on the first one, it felt like he was falling back a little bit too much. The second one, even with a defender grabbing his shoulder pads right down the middle, he's able to corral that in. That is an exciting moment of progress for me. It is. So I think Drake probably played one of his best games of the season too, especially against a Big Ten competitor when he was getting pressure on him. And it wasn't always clean for him, but Drake Lindsey, I mean, we're talking about a freshman throwing for four touchdowns, no turnovers again. Like, the offense did what they needed to do. And I think Drake Lindsey and Greg Harbaugh and these receivers in the offense, I mean, it all works together. They all deserve their flowers on their own because, I mean, it takes a village, which gets us into also the run game discussion, which I also think we have to say once again, I talked about on the preview, Luke, that Darius Taylor primed for a big game. He's healthy. I don't know when the hamstrings tightened up again, boys, but that 27-yard gain, if you don't want to have sanity, like that is the most well-blocked the offensive line and the tight ends could block that play possibly known to man. I'm pretty sure, I forget which offensive lineman is, he climbed all the way to the safety on that outside zone play. And Darius has got a hitch in the giddy up and he only gets 27 yards. That thing should have been housed is what it should have been. And it's unfortunate because I don't know what to do. And I'm glad I don't have to be the one to make the decision of, and Luke, I can't in good faith include Derek in this discussion for obvious reasons here, but we're going to have to spend some time here, I think, before Wisconsin continuing the discussion, maybe even right now, I guess, too, of what do you do with Darius Taylor and how much you're willing to pay? Because when he is healthy, he's clearly an all Big Ten running back. But that is the crux of the dilemma is Minnesota is a school with finite resources and every dollar matters. So can Darius Taylor leave and go get paid more elsewhere? 4,000,000%. But what is the cost that you're willing to pay him? And I'm not asking you to put a dollar amount on it because I don't even know what the dollar amount in my head is that you're willing to have. But he needs to find a way to health. And I know he and the training staff are doing everything they possibly can, but these reoccurring issues now, week after week, you don't know what Darius Taylor you're going to see is also part of, I think, to me at least, a major part of the offense's inconsistencies this year.
Yeah, and you know, the unfortunate truth is the data is really not controversial, right? If you're not healthy, you can't make plays. And so, yeah, I'm not going to attach a dollar amount because I'm not well versed in this, but it's going to be interesting to see how they move forward with this. And the other reality is, like, I am encouraged with Femi Ijeboy as a runner. He is not the all around player that Darius Taylor is. I don't think anybody would argue that.
At least not yet.
Yeah. Again, yeah.
I'm willing to say he's only a redshirt freshman and he could develop more as a pass blocker and as a receiver potentially, but I just want to say I completely understand what you're saying.
But I would say even Darius is a true freshman, you know, just looked better as an all-around playmaker. Now, I do like Femi as an option going forward. You know, obviously you hope Turner can get healthy. Hopefully they have some guys in the stable. I forget the guy in the that ended up going for 100. What was it, 100 yards in the Northwestern State game?
Grant Washington to the world. Yeah,
yeah, I liked him too. I don't know. It's something where I think you really got to address up front more than probably the depth at running back.
Yeah,
that's me. So
I do want to ask Derek though. We finally saw a change because. Here's how I want to phrase it. We've all seen that offensive line coach Brian Callahan is very slow to change. Whether that's starting XYZ player over, let's say, Philip Daniels last year, it's not changing out a player on the right side of the offensive line for Daniel Falele early in his career. He certainly has an affinity, I would say, for older players compared to potentially younger players if he's forced to make a decision. And there became an inflection point where we talked about the drive where Minnesota missed the 48-yard field goal. They made the change at right guard to Tony Nelson. I know you haven't seen a ton of Tony Nelson, but are we at least open to change of what if this actually goes well? And if it does go well, boy, does that not particularly go well for certain coaches. But what do we think about Tony Nelson in the 10 snaps? Again, I know we didn't talk about this in the pre-production meeting, but he's a heck of a thrower. He's a heck of a multi-sport athlete at the University of Minnesota. What did you think of your little limited sample size in the fourth quarter?
Yeah, I did. I did look at that on the rewatch. I specifically focused on that just to see what we're looking at there. And he looked good, but I will say the game script situation was a little bit unique in that they were running some tempo. They had to throw the ball. You're just seeing different defenses, and you're probably going to see, for example, starting the game. I will say this too, from just pulling out of my own experience as well. We've talked about the struggles that the right side of the offensive line has had and why don't they make a change earlier, et cetera. Part of that is, well, it's not only the production of the guys who are playing, but it's also what the coaches are seeing in practice from the guys who aren't playing. So it could have been the situation where they were waiting for Tony to get to a level or to get to a place where they felt comfortable. What I'm getting at, Ryan, is I'd be willing to bet that going into the game, they had made a decision that Tony's ready, and not that he wasn't before, but he was at a different level where they would say, hey, look, if we need to, if things aren't going well, we're putting him in. Or if the opportunity presents, however, we're going to put him in. I from my experience, I have seen that happen where coaches, they have a guys that aren't playing, you have a, we're only going to put him in if we have to. And then you have a, we're going to put him in, we're going to find a way to get him in, like there's a level there. So could have been some of that in the development in the background too, but to get to your point, things look good. Mostly passing protection looked good, mostly passing snaps, and looked very technically sound, didn't have any missed assignments. So we'll have to get a bigger sample size going forward.
Okay.
I do want to ask you guys, though, about the end of the game situation, because I know a lot of people have some thoughts and feelings about that, where the Gophers take over with 45 seconds left after that Coy Parrish return. Harbaugh dials up a deep shot, hits it up the seam to Javon Tracy, get to the 26-yard line, and then we have a very interesting three-play sequence, gentlemen, where on first down after that play, they take a shot to the left where I thought clearly Drew Bibber was interfered with by Robert Fitzgerald. No flag, which I know drew the ire of the head football coach. Then, with, again, no timeouts, Lindsey elects to hit a short crosser to Jalen Smith. Okay, that's fine. Okay, you're thinking, we're just going to clock it. Nope. Going to really just get everybody spread out, and then they take the deep shot to Jalen Smith, who there's some great photos of it that were taken by the folks at USA Today Sports. It's what I use for photos on game stories, where Jalen Smith and that specific play you can see the ball not even being focused on in the frame yet. It's so far away. And you can see the face guarding and grabbing going on where Jalen Smith's trying to go up and grab it, and he's clearly being interfered with. No flag. And now I know everybody lost their mind initially because there was 1 second on the play clock. And then turns out you can challenge that. And then they actually add seconds back to the clock. So I know I've said a lot of different things right there, but the refereeing crew not electing to throw that yellow piece of cloth onto the field for either one of those. Thoughts and feelings about pass interference and defensive holding in college football, gentlemen?
Well, first, like, let's look at the whole thing, right? Checking down to Bibber was a bad throw. Like, is this a bad decision? Now, with that out of the way, that's interference. So you're at the 26. You would have been, it would have been half the distance to the goal there. Because 15-yard penalty is a spot penalty. It's half the distance, right? So you're now at the 13 with I don't know what, 10 seconds. You get maybe one or two shots at the end zone to win it.
In theory,
I don't know that. I think the first one for sure you have to call. You can't miss that one. But you know they didn't, and it is what it is. I don't know, Derek. Go ahead.
College football has a pass interference problem. I am tired of talking about it. I've feel like I've complained to you guys about it enough. The only thing I can say at this point is there are a number of things that the athletic directors and coaches and staff in the off season bring to the Big Ten officials to have what are called points of emphasis. So the officiating staff goes through and determines we're going to have rules changes, number one. And number two, we're going to have points of emphasis. And this is what we're going to be focusing on. These are the changes. So different interpretations, etc. We can only hope that that makes the list at this point, guys. This because it's not changing. It's not a Minnesota thing. It's not it's not even probably even a Big Ten thing.
No.
We've talked about it that in the NFL, it's much more cut and dry. If you touch the player after 5 yards, it's interference. College, it's you can touch him, but you can't impede his motion. You can't keep – it's just – it's too subjective. And I don't know what else to say, but I will say, and we talked about this when it happened, I feel really bad about that check down because that's just Drake going through his progression, and that's the pass he normally, but you can't do that. In that situation, with that on the clock, that gets you nothing because you what you're prioritizing there, you're going to take a field goal as a last option. You have to prioritize shots at or near the end zone. That's understanding the management of that situation. So that was very unfortunate because not only did that not get him very many yards, but that ate up at least one, if not two more shots that they could have taken. So that hurt as well.
Yeah. Maybe the other thing I just want to highlight, time of possession, you know, really low in this game. That's a function of, you know, their inability to run the ball. But also, they only had 8 third down attempts. They weren't particularly good, 2 for 8, so 25%. And the reality is they were pretty effective on dialing up explosive plays, and especially on early downs.
8 over 20 yards, me boy.
Yeah, they were good at that. So I'm not totally upset about the time of possession and the third down efficiency. Obviously, you'd want it to be better. You always want it to be better, but offensively they were good in this game. They were.
I wanted to add one more thing, Luke. If we, you know, we're 11 games in, one more game left in the regular season. Just speak for myself here. If I looked back at the whole body of work on offense this year, if there's one thing I could change, it would be going more tempo on offense.
Yeah.
The Gopher offense has looked their best when they're running tempo, whether that's 2 minute hurry up, whatever version of tempo, they've all looked better. And I think there's some reasons for that. It's you can't be as complex as a defense with your coverages. It also somewhat neutralizes pass rush because the first people to tire out are the defensive line. So if you're running hurry up and play after play, you also can't substitute, or it's very difficult to substitute. So you have the same personnel on defense. And I think that's given Minnesota the best looks because it hasn't given the defense time to set up a difficult blitz or a movement call or a disguise coverage or something like that. And I know that's really just not the identity of what a PJ Fleck offense has ever been. But in looking back at it, and this game was a perfect example that they did have that one mistake in tempo, which was the check down we just talked about. Other than that, they looked by far the most effective when they were running. They actually, and I don't know how many Gopher fans probably couldn't believe their eyes when they saw it, they actually went tempo at the end of the first half, where normally they would call a draw play, mm-hmm. maybe throw one or two other passes, and then just go into the locker room. They actually went tempo, and they looked great. Mm-hmm. So that just wanted to call that out, that's one more. And I know, Luke, you've been on that bandwagon the whole year too, that they've looked great in tempo. And so I guess for these final two games, like let's try and go tempo once a quarter just to see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
That would also require you having the ball more than once a quarter if your defense can only force one punt the last two
good
games.
Point. Good
yeah.
point.
There might be a reason they're not. Yeah.
Coming to town, all they want to do is run the football. So I get it in theory. Trust me, I do. I just think in practice, especially for this upcoming weekend, we'll see. We'll see.
All right, let's close this thing down. What else you want to get to? I mean, I'm saying get to your stuff, Ryan. Let's get to it.
I mean, it's the over, like a loss like this. And first of all, I want to say, Luke, I feel for Gopher fans who traveled to every game like I did to now see their team go 0-5.
Yeah,
on the road, like that is truly brutal. So whether you went to one game, three games, five games, whatever game it was, I mean, if you went to the obliterations of Iowa or Ohio State or Oregon, at least hopefully you enjoyed something else that day. The Cal one after dark, that one was disheartening. But this one to end on is just, it's brutal. And the amount of text messages I heard from people, which were like, and I feel like it's gotten to a point where I need to say it again. No, PJ Fleck isn't on the hot seat. He's not. Now, part of that discussion is that he would be owed $26 million, which this penny-pinching university would not pay. I would be absolutely mollywopped, gobsmacked, use your Burns bingo card here if they were to pay that. And I also don't think he's done anything to justify being fired. I don't. But I think the crux of the discussion I want to get into with you guys, just briefly here, because I know we could talk for hours about this, is the thing I'm trying to figure out as a journalist is like, how important is football to Dr. Cunningham, who is the university president? How important is it to Mark Coyle? And I know that specifically the university president has a lot more going on in her hands right now. If you've been following the news with what she's trying to deal with mHealth Fairview and everything that's going on there, I'm sure football is probably at the back of her mind. But the reality of this market and the thing that I want to stress to people is I understand your anger. And trust me, I would rather have you be angry at this football program with me than with anyone than apathy. Apathy is the greatest enemy for any of us. But the reality of this is an institution that is 16th in expenses, and they are, I think, 14th in revenue. Like, they are not one of the teams in the Big Ten that generates a lot of revenue. And Luke and I have spent so much time in the last month, it feels like, discussing how they're going to run a balanced budget here. And then I tell you that they've run football as lean as they possibly could because of the other challenges within the athletic department. And unless you're going to authorize the university president to start taking money from the general fund to start helping out the football program a little bit more, the thing I want to find out from the higher ups with, again, their words can say what their words can say, but I want to see action wise, fellas. How important is football to Mark Coyle? How important is football to Dr. Cunningham? That I understand that the program may be stagnating to an extent. I also would tell you that they continue to do more with less. And whether you want to look at the amount of, again, that the university spends on football compared to the other Big Ten schools and then where they finish in the Big Ten standings, like, I want them to take the next step more than anyone. Trust me, I do. I'm just like each and every one of you. I like covering good football teams. But, I mean, that's kind of where I wanted to see what happens in the next year here, Luke, is do you understand kind of my thought process with how important is football here?
You're talking to the wrong people. You got to talk to Cunningham and Mark Coyle.
Well, I don't even want to include really Derek in this discussion because that puts him in a tough spot. But I feel like everybody continues to wait on these big whale donors that are somehow still out there. I feel like this is Moby Dick at this point. That's not real. It's not. There's not this $5 million to $10 million to Texas A&M like oil money or Mark Cuban money. Like, that's not coming. So if there is going to be an investment in the football program to give Fleck and his staff more resources, and I'm not talking assistant salary pool, I'm just talking about trying to give them more resources to work with. I mean, we're even talking about a Northwestern team. Yeah, I bet you they're bottom five in revenue too, but they're also, isn't the Ryan family single-handedly funding like an $800 million stadium? Am I misremembering this?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics. I know they're paying a huge portion, but you have to keep in mind too that Minnesota built a stadium within the last 20 years. Yeah. So, in you know that they had to fundraise for. If you ever raise money, you kiss a lot of frogs, and honestly, it's a really tough job, and in some ways you might burn some bridges and it's tough to do. I don't envy anyone that has to fundraise all the time. And you don't know how many people you lost through that process too. Instead of, you know, made them lifelong givers. It's tough. What I'll say is, like, I think you're going at it right. I think me and Derek are probably the wrong people to be talking to. If you really want those answers, because we're just going to talk about hypotheticals, that's a question that you're going to have to get answered by other people.
Well, again, and I'm attempting to get that answered behind the scenes. I just feel like what I would be told. Again,
you're going to get the sports journalist generalities. Yeah.
Again, what I get told on the record versus what I get told off the record. On versus off are always usually very, very, very different things. So, but I also, again, I've said this on the podcast so many times. My father taught me this at a young age. I hear what you say, but I trust what you do. So I just feel like words at this stage from people within the athletic department, or even if there were to be a comment from Dr. Cunningham about the way that football is supported. And again, she has a lot of different things that she's sorting through right now. And I just don't believe football is near the top of that list. And I understand why. But for those, I just think for the people who are short-sighted and say, "What? Where's this thing going with Fleck?" Like, I just don't think you understand how hands tied they can be at times with, I even think about the upcoming portal class. Derek would be the first to tell you he would love to give them an additional XYZ $1 million to go then be able to swim in a deeper pool and get access to higher ceiling guys. And I'll be the first to tell you, well, Ryan, they swung and missed on the portal. You spent most of the episode telling you that. Yeah. Well, guess what? We just played at a baseball stadium. Just because you struck out doesn't mean you don't keep swinging. Like, mm-hmm. I have asked them, like, what are you going to change? And I've written about it, and you can read it on Gopher Illustrated, but, like, I want to see if the university itself will do something to help. Or are they just going to continue to sit here status quo and we're just going to continue to see this thing continue to be where it is in stasis.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to enact real change, you're probably like barking up the Cunningham and the Coil like trees is probably not the right place. You probably got to start at the Regents. And that's probably where you're
Look, I'm so tired of fielding phone calls from them. I know I'm saying this now on the record, and now I'm going to get more phone calls, but like, I'm going to shut my mouth at this point because I'm going to do more harm than good.
Well, I just think that like, what I don't know is they report to the Regents, Ralph, you know, indirectly report to the Regents. Cunningham directly reports. I think Mark Coyle indirectly reports to the Regents, but he has to present to them. So that's where you're likely to make change. And it depends on what they think too. So I guess I added another to do on your list in terms of getting answers. I generally think though, as a state that has, you know, one university that plays Division I football, do we consider St. Thomas Division I football?
Abso-bleeping-lutely not.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we can close that door. You know, in the reality is that, pardon me, athletics is the front door to the university. It can be a strategy to increase your profile for your university. And if that's one of the ways you want to invest that kind of money, you should do it. I don't make those rules. I'd love to see them invest more money. I also don't want to have them completely tie their hands to not have any decision flexibility. I want to have some decision flexibility. So Derek, here's a question I know you can answer. In the case of, you know, PJ Fleck and just buyouts in general, the way I see buyouts is buyouts are meant to keep and retain coaches in some ways, right?
Yep.
And I would imagine that Coyle thus far, I think, has done a pretty good job of playing that game.
Yeah, that's the escalation of these crazy buyouts that are getting all the headlines now. It's the point of that is retention, because all of these until these schools stop poaching each other's coaches, the buyouts aren't going to go down. You know, that's, you know, the question that keeps being posed is these buyouts are just getting ridiculous. When is all this going to end? Well, it's going to end when these teams stop stealing each other's coaches. I'm not here to say whether that's a good or bad strategy, but yeah, that's, that has been a strategy and what has caused, but obviously what you're seeing now is the opposite side of that knife. It cuts both ways in that, hey, that's great. Let's make this crazy, insane buyout so nobody ever takes our coach. Well, what if you want to get rid of your coach? That's the problem that teams are running into now. So it's something that they need to rethink. And, you know, I would just say, Mark Coyle always has a strategy. He's a thinker. He has a plan, and it has been he knows that his job is largely evaluated on who he hires in the most visible sports. So that certainly has been a priority for him.
All right, let's talk a little Big Ten and get out of here. How's that sound, boy?
Do you want to go through the Big Ten games?
I just want to talk, I guess, let's
talk high level.
I think we touch on two, one being the next opponent, that is Wisconsin, who took it to Brett Bielema, which I didn't have that on my scorecard on senior day for the Badgers, but they went 27-10. I had that one on in the background in my Chicago hotel room. I'll say this, and Derek, I'm going to steal your thunder here, Thor. This is a Wisconsin team that, especially defensively, I mean, they're playing as I think my grandmother would tell me, with some piss and vinegar, and this is going to be a challenge come Saturday.
Well, three teams that we talked to, either I can't remember if it was on, off the recording or on the recording, but three of the more improved teams in the Big Ten, the second half, Penn State, Northwestern, and Wisconsin. Now, it doesn't always show up in the records, and you look at some of those records, or you could say how can you say Penn State's improved? They were supposed to be so good and they turned, you know, well, I just, if you look at the more recent weeks and we talk a lot about trajectory and who's playing better in November and the team's playing better in November is often a sign of, you know, of good coaching, of good things to foretell in the future, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, unfortunately for the Gophers, Northwestern and Wisconsin are two of those teams that are playing really well. And I was surprised in the game against Illinois to see, because I've criticized Wisconsin for fan apathy. And we've talked about last year, beginning of this year, that there's something wrong in Madison. I mean, there's just no life in the stadium. It's, you know, they're showing up late. People are talking about canceling their tickets. They had life on Saturday night. Now, not only did they win by multiple scores over Illinois, their crowd was into it. They were jacked up. They were, I mean, and for, I give them credit. I got to turn around and give credit where credit is due. And I'm glad that this game is not going to be played in Madison. You know, I think we're fortunate to have it in at Huntington Bank.
Well, that's again, Minnesota 6-0 at home. The ball has broke their way consistently at home all year. And the hope would be it breaks. Maybe this is the game the defense shows up and gets takeaways, but I will say this. They need the defense to show up in the bleeping worst way. They do. Again, this is a Wisconsin offense that for the first time on Saturday night put up more than 300 yards of total offense since week two. So Minnesota has given up 467 or more in their last three games. So something has to give on Saturday.
Do you... You guys will probably talk about this in your preview, but in order for that to happen, I'm asking you guys, do you pressure the living daylights out of the Wisconsin offense and just go DGAF? Or do you say this Wisconsin offense just hasn't been good? We're going to sit back and let them make the mistakes and we're going to try and capitalize and find something on offense. I know those are two polar opposites. The reality is probably going to be somewhere in the middle, but what approach do you think they'll take?
I mean, if I'm Minnesota, I know that my defense isn't any good, or at least they're not playing well. I understand that the Wisconsin offense has their limitations, but if you watch the game on Saturday, they are about the king of smoke and mirrors and trying to do a lot of different things to do anything to generate offense. I would tell you, I would be very angry at this stage if Greg Harbaugh runs the ball more than 25 times in this game, because Wisconsin's run defense in the month of November, second best in the entire Big Ten, whereas their pass defense is much more susceptible. That being said, their pass rush is pretty good. So I think you have to play this game if you're Fleck throughout the week and say, we have to score points. I mean, we got to score 25 plus in this game. And I think the over-under started for this game. The Gophers are 2.5-point favorites. The over-under is 38.5. Now, many of you will remind me to not use this as a data point, especially when the over-under for the Northwestern game was 40. 73 points scored.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you the weather's going to be more of a factor because it is going to be chillier. It'll be the chilliest game of the season. I think like a high of 30 or something they're saying this far out. Again, we'll talk more about that on Wednesday, but it's got to be like a game like last year offensively for Minnesota where you've got to air it out with Drake, I think, early on in that game and hope that your defense can find something at home.
Yeah, I would think I'd probably go a little bit more of the DGAF on defense. You got to be careful, though, not to give up the explosive plays, which we've seen this team do before. If you look at this game against Illinois, they had an 84-yard touchdown. They had a turnover that gave them a very short field. They really only had one sustained drive, Derek. So you have to do to make sure that you don't give up explosive plays for an offense that's really struggling. I don't know what that is. I assume it's DGAF and you get turnovers, but that makes you also very susceptible to explosive plays. Yeah. Okay.
The only other one I want to touch on is, did you guys watch the Michigan State Iowa game?
I did not.
Yes.
I watched the highlights.
Well, Derek, you want to talk about some more Kinnick black magic?
Yep.
Golly, it's just... I had this game on at the place I was watching, and I just couldn't believe my eyes, where first of all, Michigan State holds, I believe it was a 17-7 lead going into the fourth quarter. And Iowa finds a way like no one else. And oh, by the way, their kicker can actually hit kicks from 40 plus yards, but Derek, Iowa and Jonathan Smith.
Well,
goodness gracious.
Well, yeah. What the thing that stands out to me, so for those that didn't see, Michigan State actually found some offense through the air against what is normally a really stingy Iowa pass defense. And if you've seen Iowa falter a little bit this year, that's been the recipe. I mean, Rutgers was able to throw the ball on them. They really leveraged everything to keep Oregon from throwing the ball on them. Then Oregon ran all over them. But it hasn't been the normal level of just complete lights out defense. But here's what got me, Ryan, is you're right. Michigan State, they basically have to hang on to the lead. So in their infinite wisdom, when the game is on the line, they end up unfortunately having to punt. And they punt to Wheatgen. Why on earth they punted to him is of Iowa's fortune. And he proceeds to run back a, what was it, Ryan, 40, 50-yard punt to put him in score, to set him up in scoring position. I mean, just, you talk about black magic. I mean, yeah, just that the, and again, it's a credit to Wheatgen that he's a talented player. He's been able to do a lot for him in different phases of the game. But my goodness, if you're trying to hang on to a lead, just kick it out of bounds. That's the stuff when we talk about black magic, like, That's what we're talking about. Like, how does that happen? Why? How can you do that?
All right, Luke, get us on out of here. Derek, thank you once again.
Yeah. All right, guys. It's been a fun season so far. This was actually a really fun game, even though the outcome wasn't great. There's this old saying that really your border rivals really make football great. And frankly speaking, if you can find a way to win this game, I think people will be able to look past the transgressions of this Northwestern game, of many other games this season. Looking forward to breaking down that game against Wisconsin, hopefully with a win, but also looking forward to previewing it. Again, thank you for listening to this episode. Thanks to our sponsors. Support those who support us. And go Gophers.